Hey guys, this is Vyom Joshi with Superior North. Welcome back to my channel. Today we will be talking about Fiserv, which is a global fintech and payments company. Seth Klarman, according to the Q4 2021 30-F filing, took a position in this company. In this video, we will be talking about the company's business, then review the company's fundamentals by going over its key ratios, and finally find the intrinsic value of the company. So let's dive in and review Fiserv Inc.
Hey guys, let's start off by looking at the Form 10-K, which is the annual report that Fiserv filed with the SEC. On page 5 of this report, the company provides a business overview. It states that Fiserv is a leading global provider of payments and financial services technology solutions. The company serves clients around the globe, including banks, credit unions, other financial institutions, corporate clients, and merchants. Fiserv helps its clients by providing services that include account processing and digital banking solutions, card issuer processing and network services, payments, e-commerce, merchant acquiring and processing, and the Clover cloud-based point-of-sale solution. The point-of-sale system is simply a technology that allows the buyer and seller to have a seamless transaction. The company specifies that most of the services that it provides are non-discretionary in nature. What this means is the company is likely going to have stable revenue even during economic downturns. Next, the company states that its processing and services revenue, which in 2020 represented 82% of its total revenue, was primarily generated from account and transaction-based fees under multi-year contracts that generally have high renewal rates. In the table below, we can see that about 87% of the company's total revenue came from within the United States, and about 13% of its revenue came from its international sales. Over the past 3 years, the percentage of the company's international sales is growing. The company states that after its July 2019 acquisition of First Data, it realigned its reportable segments. It currently has 3 reportable segments. First is its merchant acceptance segment. Second is its financial technology segment. And third is its payment and network segment. The merchant acceptance segment provides services that include point-of-sale merchant acquiring and digital commerce services, mobile payment services, security and fraud protection products, Carrot, which is its omnichannel commerce solution, and its cloud-based Clover point-of-sale platform. These acceptance solutions enable businesses to securely accept consumers' electronic payment transactions online or in person. These payment transactions represent credit, debit, store value, and loyalty payments, whether a physical point-of-sale device, a mobile device such as smartphone or tablet, or e-commerce transactions over the internet. The company's services include payment authorization, settlement, chargeback management, and solutions that secure payment data from end-to-end, including TransArmor, its encryption, tokenization, and PCI-compliant solutions for data in transit. On the next page, the company provides us more detail about its financial technology segment. The fintech segment provides financial institutions around the world with the technology solutions they need to run their operations, including products and services that enable financial institutions to process customer deposits and loan accounts, and manage an institution's general ledger and central information files. And finally, on the next page, the company provides us detail about its payment and network segment. The company states that it provides products and services required to process digital payment transactions. This includes card transactions such as debit, credit, and prepaid card processing and services, a range of network services, security and fraud protection products, and card production and print services. Now that we have a brief understanding of the company's 3 operating segments, let's go to page 71 where the company breaks down its revenue across these operating segments. We can see that the acceptance and payment segment brings in majority of the company's total revenue. As the acceptance segment brought in about $5.5 billion, the fintech segment brought in about $2.9 billion, the payment segment brought in about $5.5 billion, corporate and others accounted for about $925 million, and the company's total revenue for the year 2020 was about $15 billion. So we can see that the acceptance and payment segment accounts for about 2/3 of the company's total revenue. Now that we have a brief understanding of the business, let's review the company's fundamentals by going over its key ratios. Hey guys, I'm on Morningstar looking at Fiserv Inc. Under key ratios, we have the financials. The first item on the list is the revenue. The revenue is the top line of the income statement. This is the amount of money that the company brings in via sales. Back in 2011, the company's revenue was about $4.3 billion. And for the trailing 12 months, that number had grown to about $15.8 billion. The company saw a big jump in its revenue in 2019. This is because of its First Data acquisition. Over the past 10 years, the company's revenue has been trending upwards. Next, looking at the operating income. The operating income is what's left with the company once we subtract the cost of goods and operating expenses from the company's revenue. Back in 2011, the company's operating income was about $996 million. And for the trailing 12 months, that number had grown to about $2.3 billion. Over the past 10 years, the company's operating income has slowly been trending upwards. Even though the company saw an exponential increase in its revenue, the company's operating income did not see that same amount of growth. This is because of the depreciation and amortization expenses, which brought down the company's accounting numbers. However, when we look at the company's cash flow numbers, which we'll soon get to, we do see that the company's cash that it brought in did increase, even though the company's operating income did not see a significant change. And just an aside, the way big acquisitions work is when a company buys a big asset, that asset, rather than the company expensing all of it on the single income statement, it decides to expense it over a long period of time. And in doing so, what it does is it pushes all that asset on the company's balance sheet, and over time, it'll expense that as depreciation or amortization on the company's income statement. So what you would see is the company paying this two-step process where first, it'll capitalize all its expenses, that is, it'll push it all on the asset section of the balance sheet, and over time, it'll depreciate and expense it on the income statement. And that is just this two-step dance in a nutshell. First, you capitalize and then expense over a period of time. Next is the net income. The net income is the bottom line of the income statement. This is the amount of money that's left with the company once it pays for the cost of goods, operating expenses, non-operating expenses, interest on its debt obligations, and taxes. Back in 2011, the company's net income was $472 million. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $1.3 billion. Over the past 10 years, the company's net income has always been positive, which tells us that the company has always reported a profit. Ideally, we want the company's net income, operating income, and revenue to have a similar trend. That is, we want these numbers to be positive, staying steady, or increasing. After that, looking at the shares outstanding, back in 2011, the company had 288 million shares outstanding. Then the share count went up in the year 2012 when it had 550 million shares outstanding. Ever since then, the company appeared to have been buying back its shares as its share count dropped down to about $413 million in 2018. Then we know that the company acquired First Data, which is when it issued more shares, hence the share count went up to about $683 million as of 2020. And over the past 12 months, the company's share count has decreased to $675 million. What this tells us that the company has been buying back its shares. And when a company buys back its shares, it actually helps increase the existing shareholders' ownership within the company. Next is the book value per share. Book value is what we get when we subtract the company's total liabilities from its total assets. A positive book value per share tells us that the company has more assets than liabilities on its balance sheet. Back in 2012, the company's book value was about $6.4 per share, and for the trailing 12 months, it was about $46.88 per share. We do see the company's book value per share jump up in the year 2019 when it got to about $48.05 per share. This jump in book value goes hand in hand with the discussion that we had earlier about how companies decide to capitalize the big acquisitions that they make, and after a while, they expense those acquisitions. So initially, all those acquisitions and assets get pushed on the company's balance sheet. And after a while, those assets get depreciated. That's why you see the asset portion start coming down, and hence the company's book value per share starts decreasing as well. Finally, looking at the free cash flow. The free cash flow is what we get when we subtract the company's capital spending from its operating cash flow. Back in 2011, the company's free cash flow was about $761 million. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $2,852 million. Over the past 10 years, the company's free cash flow has always been positive, which tells that the company's operating cash flow has always been greater than the company's capital spending. It's important to note that even though the company's net income did not see a big increase after the First Data acquisition, the company's cash flows did increase significantly. So even though the accounting does not really jive with the acquisition, the true economics, the cash flow that the company is able to generate is significantly higher now than it did before the First Data acquisition. Now let's look at the profitability of the company, focusing on the net margin. The net margin is the ratio of the company's net income to its revenue, so it compares the company's bottom line to its top line. Back in 2011, the company's net margin was about 10.88%, and for the trailing 12 months, it was about 8.23%. What this means is every $100 that the company made in sales over the past 12 months, by the time it paid for its cost of goods, operating expenses, non-operating expenses, interest on its debt obligations, and taxes, it had $8.23 left as pure profit. Again, it's important to point out that the company's net margin numbers are artificially depressed after the First Data acquisition because of its non-cash expenses such as depreciation and amortization. However, in reality, the company's operating cash flow has increased significantly after the acquisition. Next, looking at the return on equity. The return on equity is the ratio of the company's net income to its shareholders' equity. Warren Buffett prefers to only invest in securities that have a return on equity of 8% or greater every year for the past 10 years. Back in 2011, the company's return on equity was about 14.55%, and for the trailing 12 months, it was about 4.11%. Fiserv's return on equity numbers were greater than 8% every year until 2018. And after the acquisition, the company's net income numbers were depressed, which is why we're seeing low return on equity numbers. The three ways of increasing a company's return on equity numbers are first, by taking on more debt. That is, when a company becomes more leveraged, it can report high return on equity numbers. Second is when the company's income numbers start going up. And third is when the company buys back its shares, it can increase its return on equity numbers. Next is the company's return on invested capital. This number gives an idea of how good the management is at allocating the company's capital and getting a return on that investment. Back in 2011, the company's return on invested capital was 8.92%, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 3.52%. Finally, looking at the company's interest coverage, the interest coverage is ratio of the company's income to its interest obligations. So it gives us an idea of how many times can the company pay off its interest obligations using its income in that calendar year. Back in 2011, the company's interest coverage was about 4.88 times, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 3.31 times. Benjamin Graham, the father of family investing, preferred to only invest in securities that had an interest coverage of 5 times or higher. Since all these numbers are tied to the company's bottom line, that is its net income number, and we know that the company's net income number is depressed due to its non-cash expenses, so in reality, these numbers could be a lot higher if the company did not have any of those non-cash expenses. Now let's look at the financial health of the company, focusing on the liquidity ratios. The first item on the list is the current ratio. The current ratio compares the company's current assets to its current liabilities. Ideally, we want the company's current ratio to be greater than 1.0, as it tells us that the company has enough assets to fulfill its liabilities over the next 12 months. Back in 2011, the company's current ratio was at 0.98, and for the latest quarter, it's at 1.05. Next is the quick ratio. The quick ratio is similar to the current ratio, except we disregard the inventory component. In other words, quick ratio is equal to current assets minus inventory divided by current liabilities. Back in 2011, the company's quick ratio was at 0.72, and for the latest quarter, it's at 0.21. And it's okay for the company to have low quick ratio because in this scenario, the company's inventory is its settlement assets. And it's natural for the company during the transaction process to have settlement assets, which is the amount of money collected from consumers. And eventually, those settlement assets are going to be paid away to the merchants. Next is the financial leverage. The financial leverage is the ratio of the company's total assets to its shareholders' equity. A financial leverage of 1.0 tells us that all of the company's assets are financed via its shareholders' equity. A financial leverage of 2.0 tells us that half of the company's assets are financed via liabilities and half of them are financed via shareholders' equity. A high financial leverage tells us that more of the company's assets are financed via liabilities. Back in 2011, the company's financial leverage was at 2.62, and for the latest quarter, it's at 2.40. Over the past 10 years, the company's financial leverage, for the most part, has stayed fairly consistent. Finally, looking at the debt-to-equity ratio, this ratio compares the company's total debt to its shareholders' equity. Ideally, we want the company's debt-to-equity ratio to be less than 1.0. Back in 2011, the company's debt-to-equity was at 0.99, and for the latest quarter, it's at 0.65. Now, let's look at the company's efficiency ratios. The first item on the list is the day sales outstanding. The day sales outstanding number gives an idea of how many days go by from the day the company recognizes its sale to the date actually receives cash for that service rendered. Back in 2011, the company's day sales outstanding was about 52 days, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 59 days. Ideally, we want the company's day sales outstanding number to be staying steady or decreasing. What we do not want to see is a company whose day sales outstanding number is growing rapidly, as it tells that the company's management is being aggressive with its accounting, as it's trying to recognize its revenue sooner so that it can inflate its income numbers on its income statement. However, Fiserv's day sales outstanding number has stayed fairly consistent and has been trending downwards after 2019. So it appears that the company's management is not playing any accounting tricks to inflate its revenue. Finally, looking at the payables period, this number gives an idea of how many days does the company take to pay its suppliers. Back in 2011, the company took about 67 days to pay its suppliers, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 20 days. Ideally, we want the company's payables period to be staying fairly consistent or decreasing. What we do not want to see is a company whose payables period is growing rapidly, as it tells that the company is holding on to its cash in order to artificially inflate its cash flow numbers. Fiserv's payables period has been increasing ever since 2014. However, it's not growing at a rapid pace where it's a cause of concern. Now let's look at the company's current valuation. The first item on the list is the price-to-earnings ratio. Fiserv's PE is at 49. The company's price-to-book is at 2.1. The company's price-to-sales is at 4.0. Price-to-cash flow is at 16.2. And the company does not have any dividend yield because it does not pay out any dividends. We can see that Fiserv's price-to-earnings ratio is a lot higher than S&P 500. This is because of the deflated earnings number that the company has due to its non-cash expenses. Now let's look at Fiserv's discounted free cash flow DCF analysis. Over here, I pasted the company's trailing 12-month free cash flow number that I got from Morningstar, which was at $2,852 million. I'm using an annual growth rate to be 12%. What this means is I expect the company's free cash flow to grow at 12% every year for the next 10 years. I'm using a discount rate of 10%. What this means is I want this investment to give me an annual 10% return. In other words, I want to double my investment in about 7 years. I'm using a long-term growth rate to be 2.234%. What this means is after the 10-year mark into perpetuity, I expect the company's free cash flow to grow at 2.234%. This number is in line with the U.S. 30-year treasury yield. The company has 675 million shares outstanding and has long-term debt of $19,795 million. After taking all of these inputs into account, we get the company's intrinsic value to be about $85.20 per share. And when we compare this intrinsic value to the company's current stock price, which is about $97.4 per share, we can see that the company's current stock is trading about 1.14 times the company's intrinsic value. The way we calculate this intrinsic value is we look at what the free cash flows would be every year for the next 10 years. We sum up all those free cash flows, which come out to about $31.5 billion. Then we look at what the free cash flows would be after the 10-year mark into perpetuity. We sum all those up to get the intrinsic value to be about $77.3 billion. From this number, we subtract the long-term debt and divide by the shares outstanding to get the intrinsic value per share to be about $85. Now, if you disregard the perpetuity component, in other words, if you think that Fiserv is only going to grow for the next 10 years and then it'll cease to exist, then we get the intrinsic value without the perpetuity to be about $17 per share. If you disregard the debt, in other words, if you think that Fiserv is going to grow into perpetuity, so there's no point for the company to worry about paying off its debt, then we get the intrinsic value without the debt to be about $115. Finally, let's try to figure out what kind of return can we expect to get on this investment if you were to invest in the security at the current stock price. And for that, I will run a goal seek analysis. I will set my sell to the intrinsic value. The value is going to be $97.4, which is the current stock price. And I'll run this analysis by changing the discount rate. So what I get is if I were to invest in the security at the current stock price of about $97.4 per share, I can expect to get an annual return of about 9.4% on this investment. Overall, we saw that Fiserv's products and services are non-discretionary. So during an economic downturn, the company's revenue is most likely going to be steady. In the upcoming quarters, the company is going to gain from its partnership with PayPal and Venmo to its digital wallet. In quarter three of 2021, the company bought back about 3.2 million shares, which should be offsetting any of the share dilution caused due to the executive compensation. In short, the company is constantly innovating and evolving and seems to be a disruptor in its industry. Many value investors have also added the security to their portfolio. Hey guys, that is all I had for you this week. Hopefully you found this video on Fiserv interesting. If you like this content, please do like, share, comment, and subscribe. And if you have any suggestions on which stock I should review next, please leave it in the comment section below. I'll greatly appreciate it. Thank you.